This is the Paper Planes podcast, where we take a deep dive into some of the week's most notable business and marketing stories and interview high-performing business leaders and marketing professionals to find out their lessons for success.
When you look at the inner three-year-old in all of us, yeah, of course you want to get on the biggest moving thing you can possibly get. It's more about uncovering what they want. So if you're an exporter, if you're a small to medium enterprise, what are you looking for in your ideal transaction? Sales, more and more now, is about finding product market fit.
Welcome to episode 72 of the Paper Planes podcast. Now, before we jump in to find out a bit more about our guest today, I'm going to run through the usual housekeeping. Please rate and review us on iTunes. I haven't, to be honest with you, gone back and checked how many ratings and reviews we've had lately. So I'm going to do that for the next episode because I really should. I should know these things. So yeah, if you get a chance, that really helps us out. It boosts us up the rankings, more people listen, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. If you want to come and find out a little bit more about us, Paper Planes, the consultancy business that myself and Matt run, it is fly@paperplanes.co. You can email me at simon@flypaperplanes.co, or you can find us on Instagram. You can find us on LinkedIn. Come and chat to us somewhere. Add us on LinkedIn. It's always good that, you know, I get these random invitations on LinkedIn to connect. I generally accept all of them. So would love to chat to you, find out what you thought, find out which episodes you listened to, and so on. If you're interested in any production, including podcasts, go and talk to thepodcastboss.com. Our producer Gilberto runs that, and he will be able to help you out. But finally, who do we have on the show today? A gentleman by the name of Connor Hagan, a good traditional Irish name. You'll understand straight away as soon as you hear his accent that he is indeed from the Emerald Isle. He runs a business called Explorate, which is a supply chain company that helps you. It's a logistics company that is trying to disrupt the traditional logistics model. It is a startup based here in Queensland in Australia. If you want to check them out before you listen to them, it's www.explorate.co. If you want to follow him, he's on Twitter, Connor Hagan, ConorHagan. A thoroughly fascinating, entertaining guy. And if for no other reason, tune in to listen to some of the strange, weird things that Connor has transported around the world. Very, very interesting, but also very interesting to hear how he's doing in business, how he's growing his business, the key marketing things that are important to his business. So very entertaining. So look, without further ado, let's jump straight in to the interview with Connor Hagan. Welcome to the Paper Planes podcast, Connor Hagan from Explorate. How are you?
Not too bad, Simon. Thanks for having me on.
Now, for most people that will realize straight away, there is a slight Irish tint to your accent. And of course, you have the most Irish name that I've heard for a long time. So do you want to sort of give everybody a quick overview as to how you, number one, obviously, what you do and what Explorate does, but also how you got yourself into sunny Brisbane, because you are not far away from where I am today. So,
yeah, well, as you rightly pointed out, I do have an Irish tinge. That's what happens when you spend 24 years in Ireland. Having been out here 12 years, I do officially call myself a Queenslander now as well. So,
right, cool.
Yeah, I have been here quite a while. But so in terms of Explorate, what we do, so we set out about 2 years ago, with a mission to make freight simpler. So over the last 2 years, we've been refining our online platform, which essentially allows shippers to disintermediate their freight booking process. And what that means essentially is that they go to shipping lines directly and airlines directly, and engage the use of a freight forwarder a lot more smartly. So for your user or your listeners who probably aren't familiar too much with the freight industry, when they generally get a package to their door, that's considered courier freight. And when you can no longer lift it anymore, that's when it turns into freight. So we play in that heavy back end of logistics space, and we're doing relatively well at it now.
So that's actually the definition. When you can no longer lift it yourself, it becomes freight.
Yeah, well, that's exactly it. If you need a truck or a forklift, you can't exactly chuck it at the front of someone's door. So it does officially become freight then.
Wow, there you go. I did not know that. So give me an idea about who your target market is. Who are you sort of looking to reach with your service?
Yeah, so we mainly service small to medium enterprises and some of the bigger shippers as well. So essentially anyone who imports or exports at a relatively large scale. Our sweet spot is in the full container space. So, containers are actually, they're a relatively new invention in terms of, what we look at around the world. You know, they were invented around about the 50s, and they had a major impact on the fact that globalization happened around then too. So when we look at our industry, not a lot has changed since the 50s. And a lot of the bookings are done by phone and fax, even still with the shipping lines. So we look at changing that by essentially making those bookings online. In terms of the scale of the industry, about 200 million containers get shipped around the world every year. And of that, about 100 million by phone and fax. So you're talking about like 250,000 a day transactions done by phone. So yeah, it's definitely a big impact that we're having on our industry. And we want to bring that benefits to the small to medium enterprises out there.
And I did notice something that you wrote, and then you've just said it again there, that people are still booking these things via fax machines. Is that really still happening?
Yeah, like I could not joke about that. Especially if you go to like place like North China, I still get process flows that have the only option as fax. And I'll call a guy in their tech department and say, is there anything we can do? Can we API this or something? And they're like, no, you have to send a fax to this number. I'm like, okay, that's great. Thanks for that. It's a bit fucking annoying, but it is what it is. This is the industry that we operate in.
You must be one of the only businesses still in Brisbane to actually have a working fax machine.
We do. Well, actually, there's actually some online applications that you can get that can circumvent that, but we actually have a fax machine. But to be honest with you, I really like it. I like the fact that we're a bit gray. Not a lot of people know about us, and we get to do cool shit that not many people talk about, but it's really important, you know?
Wow. Now, one of the things that I looked at, obviously, from your background is you've got a background in, freighting, moving things around the world, DHL, Sea Freight, DSV, all those kind of people. And we won't sort of go into that too much because you've pretty much done your time in that. I mean, what is it? It looks like somewhere in the region about 10, 12 years in moving stuff around the world.
Yeah. And to be honest, that's the stuff that I like to get into. You know, when I started, after leaving school, I had kind of a side hustle, and I suppose being an entrepreneur earlier in my life, I had a side hustle landscaping gardens.
Right. Okay.
And one of the gardens I landscaped belonged to the managing director at the time of DHL in Ireland. And he pretty much came up to me and said, why are you still digging holes? Would you like to have a real job? And I was doing biotechnology in university. I was actually progressing my career in that direction. But the way he said it to me, it was like no messing around. So, okay, you know what? I'll give this a go. Since getting my first touch of freight, going down, making real stuff happen I was kind of hooked from the get-go. I've worked for the big guys. And
what was it about the industry that sort of got you that hooked?
I think you get to do and you get exposed to every single business out there. From pharmaceuticals, which was actually my real probably shining moment when I was back in Ireland, especially at DHL, forming a life science division. But even the small to medium enterprise, you get out, you speak to guys moving stuff around the world or coming up with inventions, trying to get it over to the other side of the world. You know, Brisbane is actually really good for that at the moment as well. But even back in Ireland, you just get in a truck or organize a fridge to keep, sensitive cargo in, and you get exposed to the insides of aircrafts and charter planes and vessel tours, get to see these big, heavy, multi-million dollar pieces of machinery, and you get to use them every day. So you get really connected to one of the other founders explains as the lifeblood of the world. It's the circuitry system of the world. getting goods and that around from country to country is the way the world operates now. So we get to do the cool stuff that actually services that circuitry system.
So I guess, yeah, you're accessing those, the big planes, those big boats, all those kind of things, which is the sort of thing that my three-year-old would get absolutely overly excited about. So I kind of guess there's that sort of little kid in you still that's getting excited with these big vehicles and, you know, big industry.
Yeah, well, I mean, name a person who doesn't get on a charter aircraft that's like got a nose-opening Antonov and like challenge them not to be excited. It's epic. Like we get to do some really cool stuff. And I think that's when our industry is kind of seen as boring and paperwork and office driven. And I totally see the opposite. And I think, you know, when you look at the inner three-year-old in all of us, yeah, of course you want to get on the biggest moving thing you can possibly get. You know? And that's what we have access to. So it's kind of cool.
What's the weirdest thing you've moved in all of your time?
Oh, that's a great question. I've moved some weird stuff. So we used to, in Queensland, there's actually a company that ships live sharks around the world. And that's mental. So I went out and I saw the guy and he's in this shed in Queensland. And it's like the guy, he comes to the door and he is this giant of a human and his hands are like dinner plates. Then he shakes my hand. He's like, Cutter, great to see you. Right. I've got this order over in Dubai and I go inside and it's wall to wall aquariums. He would have had about 50 fish tanks and sharks to ship them around the world. Not many people know this. And, you know, even people in logistics probably wouldn't understand how to do that, but you have to get a circular tank. So you have to build a circular tank. You put a shark inside the circular tank. And you kind of like sedate them slightly and you put the top on it and you put it inside a crate and you put that crate in an aircraft and you literally put a shark on a plane and send it over to the other side of the world. That's hectic. And the guy catches them by hand. So he's the guy who catches them by hand, builds these tanks, puts them in the tanks and then ships them across the world. Like that's kind of entrepreneurial, like 101.
You know, there's a Samuel L. Jackson film in that. I think there's a... They've had snakes on a plane, so you could put forward sharks on a plane because I don't think anybody would have ever imagined that that's how you ever get a shark from one place to another.
Yeah, I mean, like sharks on a plane, it's kind of like Sharknado combined with snakes on a plane. I'm already seeing it. I think I could cast a pretty epic cast of that too.
Quick, write this down.
I'll give you a part as well, Simon.
I'm going to have to die in it somewhere because I think that would be, you know... A lot of people are going to die in that film without a shadow of a doubt. I'm also guessing that you have to build a circular tank so that the shark can keep swimming around and around. Would I be correct in that?
Yeah. And that's it. Like sharks have to keep moving, right? So, and I'm an avid diver as well. So I really love scuba diving. So I've done it around the world now as well. It's one of my passions. And when you meet a shark head on in the water, they're kind of always moving, even if they're still. They'll sit somewhere where there's a current and they'll just keep kind of moving very, very slowly. They just never stop. So you got to have that capability for them to swim around. They can't swim around in the square. So yeah, that's how they move them.
I suppose there's a very strong business lesson there as well about keep moving forward. So, but I also noticed on your LinkedIn profile that you had a background in sailing and boating as well. Is it kind of fortuitous that that's sort of where you're suddenly in a garden doing some landscaping for a bloke who works for DHL and then you end up in shipping? It kind of seems a bit, you know, like fate was driving you that way.
Yeah, I think that happens a lot though. And it's something like my father is a taxi driver. So he was in the business of getting people around. My mom was an aerostess. Okay. I did work experience in air traffic control and aircraft engineering at Dublin Airport. So I think, yeah, indeed, definitely there's a bit of fate to it. But the same, I met an Uber driver last night and he was in transport logistics for Specsavers. And he was looking for a job for the last year. And he's an incredibly smart cookie. He was a master's in international supply chain. And having a conversation with him in an Uber. So I think there's a lot of, especially when you run a business or you look at progressing your career, there's a reason definitely that I'm in Brisbane, Australia, the almost exact opposite end of the world to where I grew up and where a lot of friends and family are. I definitely believe that there's a lot of unintended consequences, but that generally push you in the way you're supposed to go. So that's something, definitely when I look back and sailing, And I look back at my time in winter in Ireland, where you literally had to break ice with the front of a boat to get out and sail. And the hardship that sport at the time brought, it kind of, once again, like you're spot on. It was something that in a very early time of my life, I was definitely connected to the water and to moving stuff around.
So tell me then how, I mean, obviously, again, you know, we've talked a lot on this show with other people about, you know, you can't predict your life looking backwards. You know, all those steps that you take forwards now make sense. But, you know, back when you were making them, you know, often they don't make that much sense. But where did you sort of suddenly go, you know what, bugger this working for everybody else, let's start a business? Was that a light bulb moment, or was that something that had been, you know, nurtured in the back of your head for a long time?
Well, it actually wasn't. So I was doing relatively well. I loved the company that I was working for when I came to Australia. I had no intention of being an entrepreneur, but looking back at it, and even to the early days as I was talking about, you know, doing things for myself, and if I didn't like the way something was done, I would just go and do it. I think that's a natural personality trait that actually helps me in owning and running a business, essentially. In Brisbane. So, you know, it wasn't an aha moment when I said, I got to go out by myself. It was more an aha moment that this is a way to solve a problem in our industry. You know, we need to engage our customers better. We need to provide a level of customer service that, you know, people get in their everyday lives, but they don't get in freight. So that was more of the aha than, aha, I want to start a business because, right. Yes, fuck the corporate world. It was definitely not around that I need to move because this is wrong and I need to fix this. It was more, there's an opportunity. Here's something we believe in. Here's another person. So Alex, my co-founder, that believes in it. And here's also, you know, we got a lot of federal support. So we got accelerating commercialization as a grant in our very early days as well. So it wasn't only us that saw this problem and us that believed in it. And we got a few customers on board. We got shipping lines on board. So once again, it was more like we set a chain of events in place that made us and gave us that push to go and fix this problem ourselves.
Where did you meet Alex? Was that somebody you've known for a long time, or was that sort of, you know, was he in the industry?
Yeah, so I worked with him at UTI. He came through as a graduate program, and he was a bit younger. He still is a bit younger than me. But he came through and came out of doing his master's, or was currently doing his master's in supply chain. And I showed him the real world and brought him around a few customers. And, you know, he kind of had the same attitude that I have to logistics, which is one that this is a cool industry and I can't believe things are still done this way. Yeah. And then he went off and he actually went and toured Europe. So almost the exact opposite of me coming over to Australia. He went to Europe, but then decided, God, it's hard to beat Brisbane as a place to live. Came back and worked with Anglo American, but he kept pestering me in terms of like, we need to do something. I want to like this, you know, we could really make an impact. So definitely he was more about the passion and let's go and do this. Whereas I was more, I need to find exactly how we do this and make sure that we get other people to believe as well. So definitely he was, you know, very much a catalyst in getting this business up and running. But I know him from the last almost decade now.
I guess there's a point when you were working for DSV and you go, right, well, I'm going to quit and start my own business. Or I guess you'd probably already started it by then. I suspect it was, you know, was there a bit where you were kind of, you know, working on it on the side with him?
Well, I couldn't. And logistics is one of those industries where, you know, you have a lot of agreements and contracts that you have to adhere to. So there was a lot of, we had to be very careful in the early days, you know. And personally, I didn't want to get into that space. You know, I really respect DSV and UTI and all the freight forwarders I worked for. And it was certainly not something that I was going in to disrupt them, but there's a potential conflict there. So in the early days, it was very much, you know, Alex did a lot of legwork in terms of getting a business set up. And I then left on Valentine's Day 2 years ago and decided to go at it from there. And from there, we then on the 1st of April. So talk about like April Fool's Day and Valentine's Day as getting our two major early moments. Yeah. On April Fool's Day, we had accelerating commercialization come through in terms of a grant.
Yeah.
And that was it. Like, you know, you just start from there. And I think if I look back and if anyone else is looking at leaving the job and who's listening, You know, just make sure that you prepare and you further prepare, and then you prepare some more and you get some believers on your side and do it for the right reasons. And you'll have a far better percentage chance of succeeding than just saying, I want to be an entrepreneur or a wantrepreneur. And because this is, it's a hard gig, you know, and I know that you're, you know, with paper planes as well, you know, it's kind of something that you're passionate about and that you lead the charge. And I'm sure you had a moment probably like mine where, you know, there's an opportunity to do something, but there's a hell of a lot of hard work that goes in behind the scenes that no one sees.
Yeah.
So it's hard.
Yeah.
What? Yeah. But I wouldn't change it for the world, though.
No. I think anybody who does and has got this far down the line, I don't think they would either. It's very hard going back to work for a corporate entity afterwards. It's, you know, I did it actually for 3 months and just buckled. Well, not that that was a corporate entity. It was just working for somebody else. And after 3 months, they actually said, you know, thanks, but no thanks. And I was like, the sigh of relief when they sacked me. I was like, oh, thank fuck for that, because I was hating it at the time. So what do you do day one when you're out there? You've got your grant. It's April Fool's Day. Mm-hmm. What happens day one? What were the first things that you guys did?
Well, I think apart from going, holy fucking shit, this is mental. what do we do? I think, so the first thing you do, I think, is just work hard. You build a lot of relationships. You find out the bits that you need to make the machine work. And then you just go hard. And essentially when you pull, you know, 16 hour days, 7 days in a row, it starts to become, a little bit about, you know, balance. And then once you find the balance between work and life and passion, especially work passion and keeping your personal passion as well. So for me, it's motorbiking, scuba diving, a bit of fitness and touch footy and stuff like that. You got to have all places for that in your life. But at the start, the very day one, it's all consuming. You don't get to think about anything else. You don't get to do much else apart from just going, we need to solve this problem. How do we do it? And you have to go through a lot of failure. And I think, you know, day one, it was equal parts exciting, terrifying, and, how do we do this, and hard work. So, definitely day one was something I probably don't think about a lot, but it was definitely a bit of a jolt to the senses and, something that I know me personally, enjoyed every minute of it. So yeah, looking back on it, it's actually quite good.
And I guess you already had established relationships with obviously some businesses out there. You had, obviously a good understanding of the industry as well, but how did you find, and this may not, you know, this isn't necessarily just day one, but this is the last 2 years, but how do you find customers? You've built yourself a website, you know, you sit there, you know, you can't sit at your desk twiddling your thumbs and waiting for people to find you. So how did you go about building that customer base?
Well, I think, you know, when we built our first website, I'd hate to think what it looked like, but, you know, we had some existing, I mean, our first website was probably just basic HTML plain text, but we went to bed, and we actually, the first thing we chose was, I suppose, a name. And everybody has a bit of a different kind of start. So some people are lacking a founder and they're trying to find another founder that's passionate about things. Some people are lacking technology. Some people are lacking the business knowledge. So when you look at people starting a new business, that's generally the places that the shortcomings. Ours was definitely technology. We knew the industry and we had finance, and we had a good co-founder relationship, but definitely, our technology was something that we needed to put a lot of work into. So in the very early days, it was trying to find a good technical founder to join us on our journey. And that was a really difficult process, which I won't go into too much, but essentially it's a lot of trial and error. You got to find the right person. Now we have the right people, you know, now being a staff of 7. And so, you know, it's about that process and trying to build up the right relationships. And then I suppose off the back of that, you're right. A lot of relationships that we had over years and didn't disappear. You know, we got good people around us, good ex-employees, ex-employers, companies that we did business with, and all were very happy to throw their support behind us. And because we were really passionate and still are passionate about what we do, you know, which is, you know, finding the perfect mix of technology and people in supply chain. You know, that is a mix that's not talked about a hell of a lot in our industry, but it's something that's critical to success. You know, logistics has gone beyond human scale. but it still needs humans to fix all the problems in it.
Yeah.
And to make something run efficiently. So, you know, having that really good baseline of industry knowledge and having good customers straight off the bat, having good relationships straight off the bat, helped us solve all the other problems that we essentially were light in, mainly tech, and then learn tech ourselves. So now we can code, both co-founders, mainly the shit stuff that devs don't want to do. So if you're non-technical and start a business, I think the best thing to do is go to your developers and say, what's the thing you hate doing every day? Yeah. And in our industry, it was XML. We hate doing XML. We hate this messaging. We don't know the structure. So it's like, fuck it. Give me that 75-page schema and I'm going to read it end to end for like 3 weeks, which I did.
Yeah.
And formed the back end of some of our platform. You know, and it's still being used every day. So like I've written code, back end code for our platform, which I went into this journey with not writing a line of code in my life.
Wow.
Yeah.
I was going to say that doesn't happen a lot. I mean, I couldn't write code. I mean, I could probably write a HTML link if I was, you know, if there was a gun to my head or something like that, but I couldn't write, you know, a single line of code. And I don't think I've got any kind of inclination in my body to learn it. And I sit opposite a guy who writes a lot of code, and you know, that's interesting that you actually went to do that. I don't think there's many founders that I've ever spoken to that have actively gone out and learnt code in their time.
Yeah, I mean, so we actually get all of our employees to commit a line of code to our database, and we helps our developers talk to our sales team, and then we get our devs to do sales calls. You know, and I suppose we're luxurious enough that we are only, you know, a team of seven. So it doesn't exactly take a rocket scientist to work out that we all work fairly closely together. But it's a culture I think is important. You know, code is, it seems so scary. Like, what is code? You know, it's JavaScript. There's different types of, you know, different types of things inside a code base. So having people touch it is important. Like, don't fucking break it. but if we can get guys interested in it, it just helps break down the barriers, and it's no longer, oh, they're the devs and we're the sales guys and they're the ops guys. It's like, now we're a company and we're all trying to help each other, and we're bridging gaps all the time. So, you know, we run an agile methodology which helps the whole team speak in a consistent manner towards each other. And then inside of that, and you get people kind of co-sharing a few little cool tasks. So, I mean, I like that methodology of running a business, and it won't work for everybody, but it's something that I suppose if I can learn how to write a couple of lines of code, anybody should, because I'm certainly not a dev. I can write a bit of code.
I think my business partner would have a heart attack if I started writing code.
Why don't you? You should surprise the shit out of him. Take a JavaScript for Dummies class and just write a line of JavaScript and then see what he does. He'll probably blow his mind. He'd probably love it. And that's the thing. Like, he would literally probably froth it. You need him. So maybe don't let him have a heart attack.
It would be hard to replace him. So so there was another thing you sort of mentioned there about sales calls. And again, one of the ongoing themes that we hear, or that I hear from startups, is about how important it is for people to be able to sell. And I guess you probably have a slight advantage with the Irish accent. You know, it's whenever someone talks to an Irishman, they kind of, there's always they're kind of always expected to be extremely friendly, and people have this affinity for talking to the Irish, because, you know, most of you could, you know, talk underwater with marbles in your mouth. Does the accent help, I guess, is where I'm coming from with that. And the second part of that question is, how important has it been that you guys are able to sell your product face to face or over the phone?
So I think the Irish thing is good. It's equal parts good and bad. You know, they have some people have a tendency not to take it seriously because, you know, hey, fiddly-dee leprechauns. And thank you very much, Jim Owen, nobody in Ireland knows who the fuck he is. Like, literally, Jim Owen is not a thing in Ireland, which I think surprises most Australians. But apart from the maybe let's get over this and you know, let's talk about some value here. Yeah. It does help break down the door. So I'm under no illusions that, you know, having a bit of an Irish lilt does help when you're having initial conversations. But sales, if we look at it in our organization and you asked how important it is, I think sales gets a really bad rap, and maybe we should change the name. And I know other businesses talk about customer success or head of growth and all this sort of stuff. Yeah. But sales has a really bad kind of connotation that, you know, you're pestering someone who doesn't want you to talk to them essentially, but you force them to talk to you. But sales more and more now is about finding product market fit. So sales encompasses emails, you know, digital live chat. I mean, live chat, in terms of, scripts and, you know, even things like podcasts, right? Like essentially this could be considered sales in the wider scheme of things. And it's an important thing that I suppose people, especially younger people who almost like, I'm not doing that. I would never, you know, debase myself by calling someone who doesn't know me and maybe doesn't want to talk to me. But I see it as incredibly important because you're literally getting to talk to someone. And if you just flip your mind a little bit, you get to talk to someone about something that you know really well, you know, or should know really well. And you get to impart a bit of knowledge on them that could help them. And if you go into a sale, every single sales call like that, I guarantee you're going to be 100% more successful. So it's not about, here's X-Break, take it, shove it down your throat. Mm. It's more about, hey guys, you know, do you ship freight? Yeah. And how do you do that? Or we use a freight forwarder is generally the answer to that. Well, then, you know, how do you find that process? And then talking at it from a manner like that, you get to uncover the things that are good and are bad. And then you get to give that feedback to your business so you can help them essentially have a better customer experience. And if they're dealing with freight all day, or if you're, for example, someone else is looking at scooters, if they're getting a scooter all day, there's a better experience to be had if you talk to people and you understand what they like and what they don't like. And then match that in the digital world with data. Because sometimes you call people and go, hey, how do you find your experience? Yeah, it's great. Get off the fucking phone. But then if you actually put the data and overlay that on top of it and go, well, why did you click here? Why do you do this? You know, and you ask them intelligent questions about, you know, sets of data that you have. It enables you to have a conversation where they're like, oh, well, actually, you're right. I do that quite a lot. And funny enough, I spend my day inside a spreadsheet, which I use to fix that problem, but that takes up 20% of my time. And we go, well, maybe by doing it this way, you can eliminate that whole spreadsheet. And then all of a sudden, it's an aha moment. Mm. Going, how good is that? I've just did that. I've literally helped someone save 20% of their time. That could be 20% of the time they spend with their kids or 20% of the time they get to go skateboarding or, you know, whatever floats your boat.
Yeah.
That's the thing that I think is, you know, incredible about sales. And that's why I think it's really critical and that you have good salespeople in your organization. It's not because of trying to sell goods. It's trying to understand your customers.
I think the other thing that I often find with sales is that we use a funnel. You know, whenever I do a strategy session, we use a funnel. And to, you know, it's the classic marketing funnel. You know, and whoever you speak to, whoever you've done these strategy sessions, the sections of the funnel change names, you know, whatever. And there's one that we use that's awareness, interest, decision, action. That's the process that people go through to purchase something.
Yep.
We've also seen one from a previous guest on the podcast who talked about the section of the funnel being know, like, trust, and buy. So you have to take people through the process of knowing who you are. Then you have to take the process of them liking who you are.
Yep.
And then you have to make them trust you, and then they buy.
Okay.
Now, where I think sales really fits in well is that trust element. Because trust isn't a thing that happens, you know, in a split second. Trust happens over time. And often one of the things that people are going to need to do with an organization like yours is trust you because, you know, you're moving their shit around the world, you know, you know, and they need to trust who you are. And that's to me where a salesperson really fits in because that human contact builds trust a lot quicker than a website can, than a bot on a website, on a website can, or a Facebook page or all those kind of things. Human interaction builds trust really quickly.
Definitely. Well, I think as well that you've got this kind of, you know, it's an ecosystem of trust. So, you know, how do you build trust online and build trust in a platform, especially when you don't interact with a person every day? And we come from an industry that is very relationship driven. And then what aspect of sales/phone calls and customer service, what impact does that have on levels of trust if you can't call someone? You know, especially if it's a 9-to-5 industry, which freight essentially is, but boats move all the time, planes fly all the time, yet, you know, office hours are 9-to-5. So that's where this digital merger and why I talked earlier about the mix of people and technology is important, not only just to get the job done, but also when customers want an experience with freight or with anything in general, they want to have a good mix. And you're right about the trust element. You know, that's not something that comes overnight. It's not something that comes just from a phone call or from a website, but definitely a combination of multiple different factors can definitely form trust. Like, hey, this guy is looking out for me. This company has my best interest at heart. And this company is going to try and make good decisions on my behalf. And they're going to do it as well by giving me live interactivity with my current freight status. And that's something where I think that unlocking of true trust in an organization that is primarily digital is something that is yet to be unlocked in a lot of industries, not just ours. But it's definitely something that we focus heavily on. And I'm sure that you could probably give a lot of insights on that kind of trust element too.
What are some of the other channels that you use from a marketing perspective? Where are you getting leads from? Because it's all well and good. Obviously, you've gone to the market with an existing platform, but you need to find, you know, you need people to find you who never knew who you guys, you know, were.
Yeah.
So what works best for you guys?
Well, there's a couple of different things, but I'll give you a good kind of insight into someone who's done it really well and how they've done it. So I don't know if you've heard of Flexport in the USA. So have you heard of them by any chance?
No.
So Flexport, they raised $1 billion. You know, it's a kind of a unicorn of freight in Silicon Valley. And the founder of that previously founded a company called Import Genius. And essentially all Import Genius did was take the data of every importer into the USA and find where those goods came from customs declaration. So essentially they can determine the trust and authenticity of buyers and sellers in international trade for the USA. So it became incredibly valuable. People use it as a primary resource to see if, hey, I'm buying stuff from China. Is this company in China real? So that's something that a competitor did. And then they used that list essentially and forms a really good lead list in terms of importers and exporters for the USA. And now they've created a digital freight forwarder and they raised $1 billion and are raised over valued at over $4 billion at the moment. Now, when we look at what we do, and we take some key learnings from that, but also from the general industry. So yes, leads are relatively difficult to come by, but there are a couple of publicly available repos of importers and exporters in and out of Australia. So, you know, we should know where we're getting our stuff from, and we should know who exports stuff because it's customs essentially has to process that information, and there has to be an element of trust there. So we do access those repos of data. And that provides us a hell of a lot of customers to call and also target. So targeting sounds so aggressive too when I say it, but it's not like we draw something like on a dartboard and throw a dart at it and say, hey, listen, we've targeted that customer really well. It's more about, you know, uncovering what they want. So if you're an exporter, if you're a small to medium enterprise, what are you looking for in your ideal transaction? And that's something then when we, you know, look at converting that lead and converting someone that we kind of know to someone who kind of trusts us. So I don't know what you were talking about earlier in terms of the four stages, but essentially bring them that journey.
Yeah.
And that's something that if you call 1 or 10 people and only get 1 at the far side, well, then maybe improve what you're providing them to increase that conversion rate. And then you have to call less people and you don't need as big lead lists. And we also use SEO and SEM strategies in terms of marketing.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's kind of publicly available stuff, but, you know, we do a relatively okay job at that as well. And then just some industry specific stuff. So, talking about, containerization, talking about freight in general, how supply chains work. I was at a digital, supply chain, panel discussion last week, talking about how that's going to work in the future. There was 140 people there. Okay. And out of that, we've got already about 15 leads. So, right. You know, it's about trying to, you don't do it just for sales or marketing, but you do it as part of that ecosystem of trust you're trying to create, and that creates its own kind of demand and that own kind of interest that people come to you.
Yeah, I mean, that's public speaking. I say to people all the time, you know, there's not a lot that's better in terms of getting up in front of a group of people and talking about your business. And, you know, they don't all necessarily need to be potential leads. Some of them could be, you know, husbands or wives of people who work in similar kind of industries. I just think, you know, that opportunity to stand in front of a group of people is one of the best marketing tactics in the world.
Yeah, and listen, I agree. And not a lot of people do. I think as well, I understand why though. So this is something that I personally struggled with at early stage in your business. So when you're a founder and your business is less than, say, a year or a year and a half old, you're still figuring out what you're doing. And when you're still figuring out what you're doing, it's like when you're figuring out how to walk. You're not going to go and sprint straight away. So you're not going to go and try and walk in front of 1,000 people for them to clap you. You're probably going to walk in front of mom and dad, right? And that's the type of thing that you'll do early on in your business. And that obviously creates a fear of speaking in front of a lot of people because, hey, it's your reputation. And if you say something that might not be correct because you're still trying to figure stuff out, I understand that tentativeness. And hey, we did the same thing for the first odd year. I didn't speak at any conferences. I went to a lot. I learned a lot. I understood what domain and the problem domain, understood some of the solutions that are out there, understood our solution. And then when you've got a bit of confidence, just go hard and try and talk to people about it. And it's not about trying to convince people. It's not about trying to, you know, sell yourself on stage. You're not Beyonce. Well, I'm certainly not Beyonce. But it is really about that. Hey, listen, guys, you know, here's an opportunity. And if 10 people believe you, you have 10 believers. Yeah. And they're going to tell 10 other people. And they might tell 10 other people. And all of a sudden, you've got this network effect that you've created by just having one conversation that touches 100.
I just want to take a step back to something you said earlier on. And I think you've made a great suggestion to, you know, for a lot of businesses out there, that data mining, which I guess is what, you know, you were talking about that company in the US does and what you're doing is data mining potential clients. Yep. That's a fantastic opportunity for you to build a, you know, to build a set of leads.
Yeah.
I guess when you get that data, is your next step a cold call or a cold email? What do you do once you have that spreadsheet of people that could potentially buy from you?
Yeah, hell no. Don't do that. So don't get like we get it all the time. Here's like 2,000 leads. First, you got to qualify massively. And I think the more effort you put into preparing that list, so if you want to use like data mining as a thing that we do, which is, I suppose, the one way it is, you know, then data cleansing is something. So get either someone to look at the quality of that data, whether it's by surfing LinkedIn to see if that contact is still at the company. And also if that contact is still relevant in that company, because people change jobs. You know, they change it yearly every 2 years. So I'm going to call someone and say, hey, listen, I just want to talk to you about your logistics. And then all of a sudden it's like, well, actually I'm in finance and I'm not even at that company anymore. So, you know, get lost. It just creates instantly that it stops that element of trust. Cause I'm like, where did you get my information? I don't trust you instantly. So firstly, yeah, definitely cleanse that data, qualify the lead. And then, you know, when you talk to someone, you know, research the company, talk about something that's meaningful to them. Like, hey, I noticed that you just launched an office in China. You know, how are you finding that process? Is it good? Do you speak to them often? How many people do you have over there? Like genuinely give a shit. And then people will genuinely give a shit back about you.
Yeah.
If you go in and say, hey, I've got my product and you need to buy this because it's the best thing since sliced bread, automatically it's that, you know, and you hit the nail on the head when you said trust. You got to build that trust, and you don't build it by forcefully forcing your business on someone. It's like giving a shit about what their day-to-day life looks like, what their company is trying to achieve, what their role is in that goal, and then give them something that makes their job either easier or better, save a bit of cash, whatever it is, you know, understand what's important to them. So then you can configure, and we configure our business a hell of a lot around that. You know, you're not here to make people spend more and do worse.
Yeah.
We're here to give people the opportunity to do things a bit better. So yes, sell that to them. And in terms of sell that to them, just understand what they do a bit more so that you can have a meaningful conversation. That's definitely when we go through that process, you know, qualifying is massively important and understated massively when you talk about, you know, interfacing customers for the first time.
My last three questions for today, my sort of normal last three questions, but I'm just going to reverse them a little because
awesome.
I want to kind of understand, not necessarily what you've got plan for the rest of the year, because, you know, I think you're in a long-term business. I don't, you know, there's obviously growth strategies for you. What I'm kind of more interested in finding out is where you see this going. Is your goal to sort of build this fantastic business and sort of live off that for the rest of your life? Is there an exit plan, or is there other opportunities, other brand extensions? What's the goal?
You know, in your
plan, where are you going to get to?
Well, to be honest, I want to have an impact on the industry. That's my personal goal, and the company's goal is the same. You know, we want to change the way that businesses interact with their freight, and we want to make it more positive. So, in terms of a high goal, that's something that we want to achieve as a team. I'd never think of exit, and it's not because of it's not attractive to say that, honestly, but just because there's so much work to be done. And it's something that I like doing. So
yeah.
I think it's like asking someone genuinely, when are you going to retire and play golf and not do anything anymore apart from just live off something that you've done that was kind of okay with your life. If you look at some of the stellar leaders in our industry, if you look at Paul Little from Toll, or you look at, some of the guys at DHL, and you look at the ugly arcs of our industry, you know, you have MSC, and the founder is still alive. He's one of the last founders alive in his in shipping lines, from the original shipping line, containerized shipping line, Ugly Arts. And he still, at 85, goes into the office, albeit in his like Rolls Royce and private jet. He goes into the office and doesn't let people leave until he leaves, right? So there's definitely, we need the new generation of that. And I think there's a lot of people coming up in our industry that will be. And essentially, the companies that are associated to those people are very important right now. That's where we position ourselves as a company of change, with individuals who have a long-term goal to facilitate in that change. And yeah, there might be more sub brands off the side. So when we talk about things that need done in our industry, booking a freight is one thing, interfacing a freight is another, but just essentially getting consumers engaged in it is something that's incredibly important, so that we can make it better and more efficient, because it's not efficient right now.
Okay.
So that's something definitely, when we talk about exits or we talk about higher goals, is to really have impact on our industry and do that for a long time.
My second to last question, brands that you enjoy or you respect and look at and think they're doing a killer job. And ideally, I mean, you've mentioned a lot of brands sort of within your industry, but ideally brands that you see outside your industry that you like.
I'll try and break it up, because there's obviously, I love looking at companies who do well in different industries and different sectors. I'll firstly start with repping a local startup who I think is doing an incredible thing, World's Biggest Garage Sale. So Yaz, incredible founder, doing good things in the circular economy, which Australia is actually really, really terrible at. Really, really terrible when you look at recycling, and when you look at, you know, that what happens to your goods after they come, get returned, or when you, the mass packing we have. You know, you look at initiatives like back in Ireland, even when I left a decade ago, we're more advanced than what we have here. So she's doing an incredible job in something that needs to be done in reusing old goods and also looking at the life cycle of goods. When I look at brands that I respect and look towards globally, I look at some of the bigger brands. I really like Google. I really like the way that they architected their company with Alphabet and all the different industries that they play in. All of it, not necessarily awesome in terms of, you know, progressing the digital industry. But, you know, you got like everything from Boston Dynamics through to Google Search, Gmail, G Suite. And I know there's people like coming and essentially trying to do Google better, but I really like the way that they've set their business up and the way that they run their business and the things that they do and invest in. That's something that I look at in terms of where is the world going, kind of look at that. And then obviously we look at, I think in terms of a person, then you look at what Elon does over in the US with SpaceX and Tesla and stuff like that. It's hard not to admire that. Even though he can be a bit of a fruit loop and a fruitcake on Twitter, at the end of the day, he's given the world like electric cars en masse as a brand, not as a feature. Yeah. He's giving people the access to space, and he's building tunnels to improve the way that people move around cities, which is a massive emerging problem. So yeah, fuck all the people who think that he's not doing a good job. If someone wants to try and do a better one, go at it. You know, I think that he's definitely doing some cool stuff, and take away the fanboy stuff. He's actually, he's doing meaningful.
Yeah.
So that's essentially the three things I look up for.
Yeah, I mean, look, I totally agree. Some of the stuff that he, you know, is implementing is some of the stuff that, you know, we all sat there in the back of our heads going, you know, we need electric cars. We generally genuinely want electric cars. We genuinely want solar panels, you know, solar tiles on the roofs and things like that. I mean, that, you know, that those all make absolute sense from an evolution of, you know, that, you know, evolution of human existence. The, mm-hmm. you know, the problem I have is just the way it's done by what is, you know, evidently becoming more and more of a complete and utter crackpot. It's just, you know, the whole neural link thing that came out the other day, I read that and you just go, when he releases a paper that has no peer reviews on it and has no other authors on it other than himself, you just go, right, he's finally gone bonkers, you know?
Yeah, but Van Gogh cut off his ear though, right? Like, so, like, brilliant people do dumb fucking things. Well, he's just a brilliant person doing some dumb things. I can honestly say, hand on my heart, if I ever become successful, I will do dumb things. You know, Seth Rogen does arguably dumb things. Like, all these people that are good at their craft, you know, sometimes they do dumb things. And
I totally agree. But Seth Rogen, for example, it delivers. You know, he's constantly, you know, actually producing things. Whereas you go, where are my solar fucking tiles that were supposed to be on the roofs of you know, of our houses? And that was 2006.
Yeah, it was way easier to make jokes and grow pot than it is to like actually have impact. But like, I agree with you in certain things, but like, I don't know how Seth Rogen is actually productive at all, seeing as he does spend 99% of his life completely baked. So you got to admire that. If he wasn't stoned, how effective and how world changing would he be? Anyway, yeah. So on to the last question, I suppose. We're on the finale. Hit me with the big one.
Yeah. Like, well, my last question was, this is probably the most boring one of the lot, is how people can get hold of you if they're interested.
Let's say the unpopular answer, I'm going to give the unpopular answer, is if you can't find me, then that's something that you should probably work on, how to find people. If you Google my name, I'm pretty much top of all results. And if you want to look for me on LinkedIn or Twitter, I don't have the world's most common name. I'm not John Smith. In terms of the company, you can find us at xbrite.co. So if you really want to change the way that you move your goods around, please do reach out to us on there. There's multiple ways to reach out to us: live chat, emails, socials. But yeah, essentially, if you want to get a hold of me, you'll be able to find me.
Yeah, cool, wonderful. Look, mate, thank you very much for your time today.
Okay, excellent.
It's been fantastic having you on, and hopefully everyone got some great insights. And look, really appreciate you spending the time with me today.
Yeah, no problem at all. Really enjoyed that. Thanks, Simon. Appreciate it.
That's pretty much it for episode number 72 and Connor Hagen from Explore8. Thank you very much for tuning in again. We really appreciate your time. If you get a chance, if this is your first time here, please go back and listen to some of our highlighted episodes. I would thoroughly recommend Glenn Richards, who is episode number 70, the Shark Tank entrepreneur. Very, very, very interesting, and probably our biggest show ever. Otherwise, we look forward to welcoming you back next week.